Question of the Joint Interim Task Force for Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement.
We are going to. The Joint Interim Task Force for Primary and Mental Health.
Corley.
I just heard most of you.
Yeah, we're hearing you through the phone.
Corley. Yeah, I just muted you.
Okay, excellent. Thanks, Corley.
Thank you. It's bad enough hearing me once. You don't need to hear me twice.
Could be a long meeting.
Okay, I would like to open the informational meeting at this time. So as part of opening comments, again, I want to thank the participants of the committee for making the effort, particularly during this busy time of the interim session. So those are esteemed representatives in the legislature. Thank you for taking the time to be here this morning. We had a purpose to carry the discussion forward, not skip this meeting, so I appreciate that opportunity. We're going to do brief introductions, and then we'll proceed with some additional information. So at this time, I'd like to go around the dais, and we'll start with Mr. Colmer.
Sean Colmer, Governor's Office.
John Prassis, Regents.
Lori Monis Anderson, Chair of the Senate Health Committee.
Sandy Teeley, Circus Staff.
Rick Kincaid, Co-Chair.
Julie Parrish, State Rep, House District 37.
John Lively, State Rep, House District 12.
Ruth Bauman, Atrio Health Plan.
Janine Smith, Chief Medical Officer, Oregon Health Authority.
I'd like those on the phone to briefly unmute and introduce yourselves.
Mary Grant, I'm the co-chair. I'm a nurse practitioner representing the Nurses Association.
Coralie Conning, physician assistant for the Oregon Society of PAs, president-elect.
Thank you. We may actually have Robin Henderson on the phone at some point. She has a conflict this morning, but she may enter the discussion during our deliberation over the next couple hours. So again, thank you all for being here. We have received two letters, which I want to acknowledge, and that we will be allowing opportunity for further discussion. And these letters first came from the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and the second one from the Oregon Psychiatric Association. And again, in acknowledgement of the importance of this work and their request to participate in our discussions, and so we will have the opportunity to hear most likely from a variety of different sources throughout these discussions over the next few months. And again, I want to thank those organizations for putting forth interest, and we'll respond directly and indirectly to these letters. So I just wanted to acknowledge those. We just received those just this morning, so we will put those into the record, and I want to thank the organizations again. So this morning, we're going to just to review the agenda, we're going to spend a little bit of time on the scope again, just for a second to remind the group that we are going to look at the broader question that was requested of the legislature, and that specifically is looking for long-term solutions and recommendations to the legislature for payment reform that address the variety of challenges in the primary care and behavioral health environments and support that workforce. So our intention is to learn in these first few meetings about the work that's occurring here in the state as well as across the nation in order to try to have a better understanding of what types of recommendations we want to bring forward. We have targeted recommendations to go to the next legislative session. We will be in discussion over the next several months with the healthcare committees and as we go through that process. So this will be a very iterative discussion. So any questions or concerns related to the scope of this work from the committee? Okay. Hearing none, we're going to proceed. And Dr. Smith has been kind enough to provide us with an overview of much of the work that's occurred over the last couple of years, really, looking at both our workforce in Oregon and the challenges that we have in that arena, as well as a very, I would say, comprehensive look at some of the payment reform opportunities that have been looked at and actually implemented in different places within the country. And so Dr. Smith has been kind enough to present that to the committee for discussion as a sort of a tool. I would like to extend to the group a set of what I'm going to call draft reform principles or sort of guidelines. And again, this is just a very rough draft of things that have come out of some of the input that was certainly present in the work that Dr. Smith has shown us, but also in work across the state. This is by no means a final document of any sense, but something that I'm hoping will stimulate some thought. As we go through this process and listen and learn, what we want to do is be able to set a series of what we would consider to be guidelines or principles that whatever recommendations we bring forth to the legislature would meet those. So try to be very intentional about the reason why we would forward any piece of recommendation for legislative action. So these are simply some tools, again, for the group to work. Mary, you have a copy, I'm hoping.
No, I do. It's on my computer.
Electronically, and I apologize, Coralie, I thought you were going to be here in person, so I will try to figure out a way to get that to you. Now, this is paper. We will send out an electronic version for comment, so I would encourage the committee to jot notes as they listen to Dr. Smith and as we have discussion to try to, again, capture your thoughts and ideas around some of the basic principles that we want to begin to construct as we go forward in the work. And so this is just simply meant to be a tool for the committee. So, the electronic version.
Mm-hmm. Hi, it's Corley. I'm actually in Washington, D.C.
Well, that's fabulous. We'll figure out a way to get it to you regardless of your location in the country. My hope is that as we go forward, the things that you write down or the thoughts that you, when we send out the electronic version, you'd send that back to Sandy and Mary and myself, and then we'll compile that for our further discussion. So, again, this is just meant to help you as we listen to what Dr. Smith has to bring to us. So. We will now turn over the time to Dr. Smith. And if you could, again, introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, I'm Janine Smith. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the Oregon Health Authority and have overseen the Office of Health Policy and Research for too long. What I was going to try to do is give you somewhat of a high-level overview. We can visit certain areas, maybe at another next meetings if you want to dive deeper in any area, but was trying to give you kind of a flavor of what we know about the workforce in Oregon and sort of the efforts underway at the moment around payment reform, which is an integral part of transformation that's going on in Oregon. I think Sandy sent out to you a couple of documents that are a little dense, but I'll touch on the findings from them. But one was a summary that we did back in June to help some of the CCOs kind of get a flavor of what was going on with alternative payment methodologies, moving beyond fee-for-service to other ways of compensating providers. And it summarizes some of the national and local efforts underway and the various approaches. The other document was a new document that was just presented to the Oregon Health Policy Board last month, and it was projections, and I'll touch a little bit on the findings from that today, of sort of trying to project and model what the needs of the primary care workforce would be going forward based on what
information we could use to do that modeling. We did this in partnership with folks at the Healthcare Workforce Institute and a health economist researcher up at OHSU.
Dr. Smith, I apologize for interrupting, but Mr. Gluckman has joined us, and if you could just introduce yourself to the public record.
I'm Bob Gluckman. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for Providence Health Plan. Sorry I'm a little bit late. I had the wrong room in my calendar. So I got to tour the state capitol. It's kind of nice.
Fabulous. Mr. Gluckman, thank you. Dr. Smith.
Okay. So in Oregon, there are about 12,000 physicians, 2,400 nurse practitioners and 1,000 PAs with active licenses practicing in Oregon. The part of the health reform efforts that the legislature passed in 2009 was a very progressive approach to trying to get these kind of numbers because it's tied to our licensing. And so there's a licensing, we partner with the licensing boards to get this type of data. It comes in kind of on a every, you know, half the providers renew once a year, 1 year, and another half the other year, so we kind of get updates every sort of 2 years to collectively really understand our workforce. So these numbers are just a little old, but we'll be getting the newest numbers here in the next few months for the last sort of two-year cycle of renewals. So there we have seen a 3% drop in the number of physicians practicing in Oregon and an 11% increase in nurse practitioners and about a 6% increase in physician's assistants. And as this report projected, is that there is a need for further growth in this area, as we all are well aware of. They tried to figure out kind of the magnitude of that. And it's anywhere from, and there's sort of ranges here because it considered, as if you work through the report, you know, just the way if the world stayed the way it is now, it'd be more the higher, say, 16% growth need for physicians. If you factor in some of the innovations around health information technology, new models of care, team-based care, it kind of pushes that back down to 7% for physicians. It's higher, of course, because part of that team-based care includes nurse practitioners and PAs and other health professionals, and so the range for those other professions is a little bit higher, 11 to 31% growth. Depending on the scenario. Again, these were just modeling. And it doesn't account for folks retiring or disappearing off the out of the state. So this just kind of...
Question, Mr. Chair? On the 3% drop of physicians, is that physicians overall or just primary care?
This is physicians overall.
Okay.
These are total numbers. They're not separated by specialty.
Yeah,
thank you. I missed that. Sorry.
And this is just sort of, in this next slide, we do sort of break out the various provider specialties in terms of, you know, types of providers that are in primary care, percentage of providers in primary care versus mental health care, and then the various practice settings. Again, this comes from our data of where people are practicing and what they report. So Oregon is unique in that not all states allow nurse practitioners to practice independently. And so this is just a slide that outlines sort of the uniqueness of our state in terms of the ability for nurse practitioners. And then physician's assistants are more in partnership with a supervising physician or physician organization. And there's been some adjustments in both cases for some increased flexibility around these. And I understand there's a bill in, or was a bill in play. I'm not sure right to this moment in time where 1548 is, but it was to add some additional language that currently, where the statutes just refer to physicians and make it more broad. So there are ongoing sort of profiles that we do from this workforce database. They're available on our website to dive deeper, and certainly we can explore this more. The projected demand report, as I just mentioned, was sent out to you all. The Oregon Primary Care Office, which is a federal grant-funded activity that our office actually oversees, and it works in terms of trying to designate workforce shortage areas and keeping that data updated and working with communities to help address their need for providers, and in terms of making them eligible for either getting National Health Service Corps providers in or what are called J-1 visa physicians, foreign physicians coming in. And so there is a lot of work around that area, and then the Office of Rural Health also works closely with the rural providers and rural hospitals. And then as part of our health reform effort, and when you all, the legislature, set up the Health Policy Board, the Policy Board has in statute and has an ongoing workforce committee that is continuing to look at what is the future health care needs. They're going to be taking this modeling and really trying to better understand what is going on in the state over the next year and continue to work on workforce capacity and categories, and they'll be reporting to the Policy Board by this fall. So there is more work yet to come in this area.
Dr. Smith, could you describe how we would account for these are total number of providers and not necessarily their full-time equivalent or the amount of time that any one provider would spend in patient care? Is there a way to understand actually the active and sort of the number of hours of workforce available, particularly with the increasing number of part-time clinicians? How is that accounted for in the workforce assessment?
There are some limited capacity to understand at least multiple locations they work at and that sort of thing, but the questions are not super, you know, not wanting to overburden the reporting requirement on their various licensees. They're not as in-depth as maybe all of us would like the questions to be. There is a workforce survey that the state has, the Medicaid agency, ourselves, and the Oregon Medical Association have done every 2 or 3 years. There's a new one getting ready to go out, or will be going out, where we try to get a little more granular data through that survey effort. Again, that's based, of course, on who will respond to the survey, but we try to make it easier so we get better response rates. But I think we get a little better feel of, you know, what are their plans? Are they planning to retire in the next 5 years? That sort of thing. I didn't include some of that because the last one was probably a good 2 to 3 years old, but I certainly can get that, the last version of that, those results back to you. But it does give you a little bit deeper flavor of the amount of work effort. And I think the Workforce Committee is going to continue to develop that as they look at capacity and new models of care and what that really does need for a future workforce.
Great. I just appreciate that. In that we do have a significant part of the workforce that is not full time, and as many of the providers coming out of training are not even looking for necessarily full time employment, or full time practice. So just somehow, if we can account for that, because it may take two providers to actually equal one older provider.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the other sort of aspect to think about is how important primary care is to the transformation of the healthcare delivery system in Oregon. And what,
so the other sort of aspect to think.
We have a question on the phone.
Yeah. Whoever's questioning, will you just identify yourself as you start to talk?
Poorly.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to update you. 1548 was unanimous to pass on both sides on Monday, and it's on the governor's desk at this point.
Could you repeat the question?
Oh, it was about 1548, I think.
Yeah, it was Senate Bill 1548 that's passed unanimously both on the House and the Senate, and it's now on the governor's desk.
Right. That's what she was just informing me.
Okay. So the coordinated care model, of which in Medicaid is the work around the coordinated care organizations that Robin and Ruth are very intimately involved in, to say the least, the real basis, or I think of it as the bedrock to a lot of the efforts going on around the state and the CCOs, and what Sean and I just spent the last week reviewing all of the applicants for the PEB efforts to try to enhance the coordinated care model in how we purchase for state employees. But the essence of what we heard this week and what we've heard from the CCOs is that the patient-centered primary care home is sort of the essence of this. This is Oregon's name for the medical home or health home. It, again, came out of our health care reform efforts in 2009 and put in statute and has actually been a very robust effort across the state, and it's really amazing to think how in such a short period of time how far we've progressed on this. But this creates a team-based care of which MPs, PAs, docs, a lot of other providers are all sort of working together to try to build that relationship with the patients and their families to deliver that enhanced coordinated care that we all want. So amazingly, and I don't even know if we've given recent updates, but I think there is actually more than this, but we couldn't, because it's a new set of applications coming in right now. The last official number is we have 465 recognized clinics in Oregon that are doing this and have been recognized by the state as either a tier 1, 2, or 3, and each layer is a little bit more enhancement of what they're expected to do and what they integrate and do in those clinics. And 78% of the coordinated care organization members are now enrolled in a patient-centered primary care home. And I think for PEB, actually, it's even a little bit higher in the 80s at this point. And we're asking in both cases to try to put this more so that every publicly purchased coverage for people is in has an access to a patient-centered home. That was what the policy board wanted to see, at least, you know, maybe even achieve the goal of 75% of all Oregonians here over the next few years. The money that the legislature gave to the CCOs recently in a form of a transformation fund, the majority of them are very focused on patient-centered primary care home efforts to provide technical assistance, because it is a lot of work to change the model inside a practice. They're used to, you know, they're busy. They're trying to, you know, fly the plane while they're changing the plane. And so it's a lot of effort that is moving forward. There are some new standards that actually enhance the number of things that you can actually claim that you're doing that would help you achieve this status, and the idea behind the standards, which were developed in a public process, and we've continually refined them and updated them, and there'll be some further constant every couple years looking at them, will be to strengthen them over time, and as people achieve more and more, that to try to keep pushing the envelope to more and more advancement of that model. We have done some initial look at who's in those patient-centered primary care home. The average number of providers, and I think this is because most of the clinics are the bigger clinics. Oh, shall I pause for a moment for our new...
Mr. Comer.
Thanks. Janine, can you talk a little bit about the private sector collaboration that happened over the last couple of months with the Health Leadership Council and the payers?
I'm going to get to that.
Never mind.
Good.
Thank you.
I didn't know if you wanted to introduce your... Senator.
Yeah. We have had Senator Knopp join us.
Good.
Thanks, sir.
So from our initial look, and there's more evaluation going on right now with, we have some Portland State researchers looking at the patient-centered homes to try to understand what they're accomplishing and continuing to monitor them. But they're mostly the first early adopters were the larger clinics. Some of these clinics or systems already had a lot of efforts to move this model. So the average number of providers in most of these clinics is around five FTEs. There's a lot of other clinical staff, medical assistants, other supportive staff beyond MDs, PAs, and NPs. They're seeing a lot of people and a lot of visits. And the majority serve adult and pediatric, and there's even a couple that are sort of maternity-focused patient-centered homes. There are a few that are actually behavioral health centers who brought in primary care. The model was always designed to be more where the patient and the family has the relationship. You'll get in a minute, there's some further efforts to try to improve that in the mental health community in bringing in that primary care. We have partnered over the years. This was initially initiated through the Oregon Health Authority in partnership with the Northwest Health Foundation to set up support to help these practices be successful at changing this model. And there's been a learning collaborative. It was the contract was with the Quality Corporation to be sort of the hub for this, where they have hired experts to work with clinics. They've done one cohort of about 25 clinics. A large number of those were clinics out in more rural, remote areas that needed who were kind of more independent and needed a little bit more help than sometimes, say, a Providence clinic or a Legacy clinic has more of an infrastructure around it, where they've worked to try to help these clinics move to this model. And they've put on webinars and toolkits are available online. And this is our funding for it from the state side has been through grants to date. We've been lucky enough to have some federal grants to help support this. They're going to be looking going forward how to sustain this support, because it's an integral part of changing to this model is providing these practices with support to understand how to, you know, get the front desk to do what they need to do maximally, the back office staff and the providers to change sort of the workflow to this team-based care. There's been some investment, as you're well aware, around behavioral health to try to enhance integration. Much of the transformation fund dollars are going to this as well. And the Patient-Centered Primary Care Home Institute has been focused with some expertise on how to have the primary care clinics bring in behavioral health expertise so the patient can actually walk in and if they need additional services, they don't have to go to another place or there's an ease in getting or warm handoff. We had some discussions when we were talking about the PEB population that there's a lot of stigma sometimes to go to a mental health clinic, and so having these resources inside the primary clinic has been very beneficial. And on the other side, the chronic schizophrenic patient builds that relationship with that mental health clinic, so having primary care come in and be there for their sore throats and their health screenings is really critical as well. So you want to try to, you know, think, again, it's patient or person-centered thinking about what would best serve. We also have a federal grant that we're putting towards another cohort. We just put out an ask aiming for a small, maybe 8 to 10. We're not sure exactly how many clinics will be selected to work on that. It's what we call reverse integration of the primary, where it's primarily a community health or a behavioral health clinic, and how much primary care needs to come into that. And we're going to continue to help support the technical assistance to achieve that model. And that's where it's really important for these MPs and PAs are integral parts of those kind of team thinking. So the other section I wanted to kind of move, so we've got, you know, this is what the workforce is and what we anticipate we're going to need. The new model of care around the primary care, a behavioral health integration at the clinical first point of care and contact is really important. And then what really drives a lot of this is payment. So what I wanted to do is give now a sort of a section on kind of approaches to payment that are occurring at this point.
Dr. Smith, but before you go there, perhaps this would be a good venue to get if there's additional questions or clarification around the models that Dr. Smith is describing. This would be a great time to ask her. Great. Go ahead.
So there's been some movement about thinking about how to support primary care on a federal level. There is a two-year opportunity for an increase in primary care payment that brings the Medicaid payments up to Medicare levels. Unfortunately, it is based off of federal rules and regs, so the independent practicing providers, a nurse practitioner particularly, cannot qualify for these. They have to be under a supervision of a physician because that's the way Medicare does it as well. There was a Medicare payment bump also from started back in 2011 and extends to 2015. There were some payments which Oregon took advantage of what are called health home payments. What we tried to do, which is a little different than what some other states have done with this, is try to really fuel that patient-centered primary care home effort, and I think that led to some of the real advance of how we got those first almost 500 clinics, is that we had money coming in through because of the ACA that we could, we wrote it so that if you took care of a certain type of, you had to have a chronic disease or a chronic mental illness in order to qualify for these, and or at risk of. So we wrote it very broadly, and we tried to get as much dollars in as we could, and for the last 2 years, this just ended in October, those dollars have been out and fueling a lot of the efforts in those homes that I was talking about earlier. It was a nightmare in terms of trying to get the money out because they had to send in patient lists, and computer systems and paper lists don't work well together, but we got most of the money out, but it was just for a two-year period. Some other states have targeted it more to particular subpopulations. We wanted to spread it more broadly, and the clinics really did value those dollars and help to pay for those behavioralists and those nurse practitioners and triage nurses and other efforts inside those clinics. Because of what this committee had been presented, I asked some staff to dig into where did this 85% thing come from that has caused some of this concern. And a 2002 report where MedPAC, which is sort of the entity that looks at Medicare payments, they actually looked at it and they found no specific analytical foundation for that, but they were reluctant to change it.
That's right.
So that's what we found.
So right now, please explain what Medicare pays.
So they pay nurse practitioners and PA 85% of what they pay a physician. So there's a 15% reduction when you're paying Medicare fee-for-service. Now, a Medicare Advantage plan certainly has probably some flexibility on how they pay. Much like our CCOs have flexibility on how they pay, but
then I want to get on the record that there's no specific analytic foundation for this discrepancy.
Based on a 2002 MedPAC report.
Jeannie, maybe you'd like to comment how Medicare's current fee-for-service system pays for evaluation and management services and the shortfalls in that in trying to differentiate the acuity of a patient and the limitations of the current E&M system.
You probably could talk better about that since you're on many committees.
So I think that the challenge is that the current payment methodology of a unit of service pays for a visit. It would pay a similar amount regardless of the complexity. So it kind of speaks to you can pay. If more services are provided in a visit, you can upcode higher, but that service is supposed to incorporate the between-visit work. So it wouldn't be hard to imagine that if someone comes in who's relatively healthy for a self-limited complaint, but their visit qualifies for a level 3 visit, might have less between-visit work than someone who has 3 or 4 chronic medical conditions and comes in for also a similar self-limited complaint. So I think going forward, you know, if we're trying to think about a payment methodology, we do need to have some way of recognizing the between-visit care and the greater complexity of care for patients who are truly sicker, and recognize that if, regardless of the credentials, if people are able to provide that service to a higher acuity population, that's where the equity should come in.
And I agree totally, and that's why I like your list, because the number one
principle is relies primarily on coding documentation to determine level of service, and that's what we have to work on. I have a friend who has a, she's a nurse practitioner who has a clinic in East Portland, and all she sees is Medicaid clients, and her clients are much more complex than someone who is seeing someone like me coming in, you know, with not very many problems.
Well, I think that's part of the paradox here, is that the least funded patient population probably has greater complexity. Mm-hmm. And but they also have a difficult time funding all the services, you know, that the programs have, you know, as compared to the commercial marketplace. So I think as we go forward, we really do want to be thinking about not trying to create payment methodology that pays a lot more for low acuity care.
Mm-hmm. So maybe I need to explain it a little simpler. So like a 99213 office visit code, you're saying that that reimbursement is set by the code, not set by the diagnosis of the patient?
Correct.
And you're saying that a methodology that added that extra dimension of the diagnosis would be a more appropriate way to create the reimbursement for the 99213?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the other things that's on here is moving away from fee-for-service. If we had payment methodology that rather than paying for visits and units of service, was actually able to pay people for caring for a population of patients where those payments were adjusted based on how on the acuity level. And by the way, social determinants of health do add a lot of complexity to the visits. So it's even beyond just the diagnosis, because if you have someone with poor social support and low income and have all sorts of barriers to just getting care, they are more challenging to take care of than if I, which I don't, had five medical conditions and have a supportive wife and have a little money in the bank. And, you know, the complexities for the caregiver are less, you know, and if you're educated, have high health literacy, you know. So I just think that there's some complexity here that goes beyond just a 99213. Not all 99213s are the same.
Okay.
And as a provider, again, I think Mr. Gluckman is correct in that they are not all the same. But the reality of the E&M coding system and the way that you actually get to a 99213 is variable. There's a subjective component and objective component. Then there is your diagnosis and the decision making that it took to get to that diagnosis, as well as your plan. So there may be differing levels of complexity at each of those levels, and documentation would have to support it in order for the total of those four components to equal what's necessary to bill a 99213. So the decision making particularly is a very important component in the E&M coding system. So how complex the patient is and how difficult the decision process to get to that treatment plan was is accounted for using the coding and documentation system. But again, also appreciate Mr. Gluckman's comment around trying to get away from that complex system, which requires an unbelievable workforce to make sure that that is has integrity, as well as the time that the providers take in order to participate in that type of coding system.
And just remember that 85% is Medicare fee-for-service, and over 40% of Oregon's Medicare population is in what is called Medicare Advantage, which are more of a managed care where there's more flexibility around payment. So you're talking about that straight fee-for-service population is about 60%. So we're one of the highest states in the country to have that much Medicare Advantage plans than other states. So I touched on a few examples here, and there's more in this alternative payment methodology about what's going on in other states. There's been a lot of efforts. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan is one example of where they have enhanced reimbursement and incentive pools, not too dissimilar from some of the stuff we're doing with the coordinated care organizations for certain designated providers. However, when we dug, it's just for physicians and specialty providers, but does not include nurse practitioners and PAs. The Vermont Blueprint for Health has been around for many years. They've really tried to sort of do similar to us, transforming and focusing on the health and wellness of patients, as well as improving quality of care, health care, and decreasing cost. And so they have had a sort of multi-payer funded community health teams, and that payment actually goes to the clinic itself rather than to a particular provider. So they're sort of helping pay for that extra stuff that we were just talking about through an alternative method than through the actual billing for an actual widget visit sort of thing. So that there are several other examples of that, and I'm going to talk a little bit in a minute about some of those efforts in Oregon, too. The other approach is in Rhode Island, and the policy board recently heard from the former health insurance commissioner, who actually has changed jobs since this got started, but when he was in Rhode Island, initiated a look at sort of using their regulatory authority fully insured insurance plans to look at the spend that the health plans were spending on primary care and starting to sort of set some targets and benchmarks. And the policy board has been looking at that and continuing to do some work thinking about how that really could, and in a collaboration with the Oregon Insurance Division, of how do you support the primary care infrastructure going forward. And there'll be more results coming from the policy board at their thinking about this over the next several months.
Dr. Smith, in that particular example, did the regulatory environment describe how those dollars were to be spent, or was
they set some targets? So they looked at where all the health plans were in terms of their spend on primary care, and said, you know, in order to get their rates reviewed and approved, they needed to bump their primary care spend up, and here were their targets. So that was just one of the approaches.
I think that in the Rhode Island model, though, the historical level of where primary care spending was much lower than it is in our state. And I can't speak for every payer, but you know, we run around 9% of premium, or 9 or 10%, which I think is kind of what their target is,
right,
in Rhode Island after the intervention. So, we're different, it's a different market. The medicine in the Northwest is not the same as it is in the
Northeast. Rhode Island's kind of like a large city and has two or three major insurance plans, and so it is a very different environment. And that's sort of part of the discussion that the policy board's been working with and thinking through these last few months as they presented their recommendations back to the governor recently, and are going to continue to work on some of this thinking. So I wanted to talk on what Sean had brought up a minute ago is, as part of our efforts of transformation here in Oregon, we've actually and helped support from our federal state innovation model grant from the feds, is we had the Center for Evidence-Based Policy work with all of our major payers here in Oregon, including the CCOs, and there was representatives from them, as well as all of the domestic payers. I think John sat through these meetings, and we had the Medical Association and the Nursing Association and the Oregon Academy of Family Practice at the table, and trying to get some consensus about what could we do to support across the multi-payers, because in any one practice in Oregon, 80% of our providers see Medicaid in Oregon, which is actually very high compared to other states. But I know from my years of private practice that I had 17 different health plans coming in the door. So if one health plan asks me to do this and someone else asks me to do that, I'm not going to do it unless I get a large percentage of my practice telling me to do the same thing. And ideally, it would be nice if they all got together and asked the same things of me in terms of metrics and reporting. So the idea being, and this has happened in other states, is the multi-payer approach is often more effective than any one payer onto themselves, depending on what's coming in the door of any particular practice. In some states, the Medicaid population is being seen entirely over in only federally qualified health centers and not the private sector. From our workforce survey from the past, we actually saw our rural providers saw a lot more Medicaid and Medicare, because otherwise they saw people who had no insurance. So so it's really trying to find the balance across the payers to really drive the change. So the payers agreed and came to a consensus that the patient-centered primary care home designation, the criteria for that, was something they could all get around as what they wanted to agree to mutually support, and that they would all start to work on their contracts with their providers over this next year or two, depending on when the contracts came up, and each would decide exactly how they were going to do it, but that they would start to think of alternative payment, moving away from fee-for-service potentially, but, you know, again, not dictating what each payer is going to do, but to start to really support these practices in this change with either a case management fee, enhanced fee-for-service fee, or whatever they could come to in their negotiations with these practices, and that they would, and then we would, the patient-centered primary care home program is working with those payers to come up with a meaningful set of metrics to see what this investment really achieves over time. The participants at that table, as you can see, is, and I forgot to mention the Association of Hospital and Health Systems was there, the Health Leadership Council was there, Kelly Ballas, our chief financial officer, and myself were at the table. So we had all the major payers there, and so it is really a great support around this model of primary care and getting the payers to all really work to this. And I think from having paid attention to what the CCOs have put in their efforts and what we've learned from the PEB, our PEB efforts, that there is a lot of enthusiasm about paying differently for primary care to really keep and help fuel this. And we've seen that in our some of our early findings from the CCOs, too. Questions about the consensus process? John could fill you all in on how much fun it was.
I just have a question relative to the number one, accountability or of the group to each other, and then how is it that you share information, given that some of this is contractual? How is it that you share the philosophies, what worked, what doesn't work? What's the process by which the group learns from one another?
At this point, the patient-centered care program staff that work under me have been working in a small technical advisory group to try to think through what would be the key metrics, and we're trying to piggyback on some of the measures we're already collecting around the CCOs as well, and what we have available potentially through either evaluation of the patient-centered home or through all-payer database, et cetera. So we would report back to this group in a year, kind of what we know, and continue to monitor it in partnership with the Oregon Health Leadership Council to continue to keep looking at this over time. Is that what you would say, John?
I think obviously one of the challenges is there's a diverse group of carriers in lots of different lines of businesses with unique dynamics. I did think we had a lot of good discussion in the meetings, and it was, I mean, to me it was very constructive bringing that group together, because as much as we had unique ideas around things, I think at the end of the conversation we were a lot closer, I think, philosophically than I was pleasantly surprised that we were all kind of thinking the same way.
And I think one of the challenges that was highlighted, and Aetna is a good example of this, they had started a enhanced sort of care management fee already before this meeting had started. But what they reported was it's really challenging when you have self-insured employers as your customer, because it isn't the same as when you're fully insured and you're taking on that risk of paying an enhanced fee. You have to convince the employer to pay that enhanced fee and not just pay the way they're used to. So the sort of what's the return on investment discussion they need to have with those employers? And so I think that's something that I've heard from other states are also having that sort of challenge, is that the self-insured plans can't just do something. They're basically paying the bills for an employer, and so they've got to work with that employer to sell them and the business on what a patient-centered home or enhancing their primary care spend really can mean to them. And so there's a lot of work there that needs to continue with that discussion.
I would tend to agree. We just passed legislation that would allow businesses less than 50 employees to self-insure themselves. And then all of a sudden, that's one issue. So they will not be subject to the standards that we have in our exchange. And an example of that is we have this huge issue on autism and covering ABA therapy, and self-insureds don't have to. We work so hard to make sure in the legislature that some of these children are being covered, yet Providence, for example, has a self-insured company. They do not cover it, and so everyone gets mad at Providence for not doing it, when actually it is the decision of the self-insured. So this is going to be really a problem maybe in the future.
Well, it is now.
So we are covering ABA therapy. The policy is, I guess I don't know if it's been announced yet, but I actually don't know about our own employees. Yeah, that's OHSU doesn't care.
A self-insured, not your own employees, another business.
Another business, yes.
Another business.
I understand, yes. That's true.
So also the other thing that's going on in Oregon, we were one of seven communities, and in our case we took it as a whole state, and some of those other communities can be just like Cincinnati or a city or here or there, but of what is called a comprehensive primary care initiative. This is an effort through the federal government to have Medicare partner on this multi-payer approach. The federal government selected the clinics. 67 of our clinics in our state were selected. Most of these are tier 2 or tier 3, a little more advanced patient-centered homes, and the reason for that is they needed to report electronic health record data back to the feds so they could track that for some of the measures. But it's been a great collaboration with Regents Blue Cross and Providence, both at the table, Care Oregon, Tuolity. This started before the CCOs started, and then we've been also participating through our Medicaid fee-for-service, which is shrinking numbers, but so those clinics are getting all those payment streams coming into them to give them a sort of a care management fee that is helping to support those practices to make those changes, bring in different kinds of providers, and change their workflow and really enhance the coordination of care. Been very positively received. I think a lot of the discussions when we did that multi-payer consensus process is Glenn Rodriguez is one of the clinics at Providence. He just thinks it's like the greatest thing since sliced bread. I mean, it was just like they didn't have to send in lists of things and all the mess that was related to our health home payments. They were just getting this care management fee. Medicare is paying $20 PMPM. That's each payer is paying what their own amount, and we don't know what each is all paying. That's proprietary information, but Medicare is paying this much. This lasts for another, I think it's we're about a year and a half into this, so we have another few years of this happening. We don't know what Medicare will do after that. The idea is that they were doing this to see what they could learn from it, and there is some proposal of an ongoing case management fee in the Medicare fee-for-service side, and I think this and some of their past pilots in other states are what is going to inform what Medicare is going to do going forward, because even if all of our payers get together, a large chunk of any one particular practice is Medicare. So what the Medicare Advantage plans and Medicare Federal does is important.
Dr. Smith, excellent point. I think that that's was one of the challenges with the state effort in that it ended. And there was no ongoing mechanism to continue to support the work.
Which is what led to that consensus discussion is
exactly.
What...
Exactly. So I think that the key part is to learn from these things and then figure out how you're going to perpetuate them over time. So I appreciate that they are looking at ongoing payment mechanisms, because I know that clinics in our area that participated in the state effort have unfortunately had to disband some of the things that they had put into place because there's no longer the funds to be able to sustain that that they did for the period of time that they received right. Those.
Although a lot of the CCOs and a lot of the health plans have stepped up to enforce that because they want to encourage that, and it's tied to some of their incentive pool monies as well. So PEB, just wanted to note that they, the PEB vendors have been paying incentive payments to Tier 2 and 3 PCPCH homes, and then the members are also receiving a discounted copay when they're in the being seen in those clinics. As I mentioned, Aetna launched a PC, patient-centered medical home is what they call it, recognition program, and it does apply to nurse practitioners and physician's assistants if they meet certain criteria. And the innovative thing is Aetna, being a large national plan, actually does recognize Oregon's PCPCH. Clinics are often certified as an NCQA, National Council for Quality Assurance, medical home nationally. Our medical home, patient-centered home requirements are just, if you're NCQA certified in Oregon, it gets you about two-thirds of the way there. There's a couple more things you have to do to be Oregon certified. The NCQA certification process has a price tag, that's why in our work group that developed it, we didn't want to require clinics to have to invest in NCQA, but it doesn't mean that we're precluding them, and then they get credit if they do it. The other interesting thing in Oregon is that there are four fairly large federally qualified health centers that are doing an alternative payment arrangement with Medicaid, with us at the state, about a lot of those clinics, they get a wraparound payment that is like given to them after the fact. And there's all this reconciliation thing that goes on. So they don't get the money up front. So these four clinics came and discussed this with Judy Moore Peterson and the Medicaid, and we got approval from the feds to try it out in these four clinics to give them some of that money up front so they could use it to perpetuate the changing model they want to achieve in their clinics as well. And we're going to continue just kind of getting kick-started as we speak. Other states in the country are looking at that to see what that is, and other FQHCs in the area are also looking at that to see if that's a successful approach.
My understanding of the wraparound payment was that it was to help account for the large number of uninsured
right.
patients that the federal qualified health centers saw. More are covered under the Affordable Care Act, do you see that, that payment model will go away, and B, how is that incorporated in some of the alternative payment model? Because you're paying up front more for the care model, less to account for the uninsured.
They're paid, so say the CCO is paying them like they would pay any other clinic. They have a cost-based reimbursement that is a formula as to what they ultimately should be paid because of a lot of the other things they do in their clinic, of which some of it is the uninsured. Some of those clinics get uninsured grants on top of that. So they also will be seeing more insured people, so they will be having increased incomes from that. I think they're trying to figure out what this new world means for them going forward, and this alternative pilot is an approach to that, to sort of true up their payments, because they do have a lot of other wraparound services in there that maybe not the average private practice has, but it is. It's having that money, as I know that Gil Munoz from Virginia Garcia said, if he just had it on a predictable basis, it would be so much better than to have it all come to us at the end of a year or 2 years later.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kleffman?
But,
I think that the federal funding for FQHCs is being reduced. It's actually an area of controversy because in the states that didn't expand Medicaid, they're not going to have the revenue and from Medicaid to make up for the lack of funding from the federal government. So I think this is an evolution, but it addresses your point that the funding was scaled back from the federal government and some of it may need to be returned in order for these centers to be viable, especially in states that didn't expand Medicaid. Right.
And there will always be, of course, some uninsured that they serve that don't qualify for other types of insurance.
So. I'm sorry, when did you start this program?
I think it's kind of just getting fully, it took a while to kind of sort out the logistics of it, so I think it's just kind of gotten underway in the last month or so. And I think at some point we could certainly have folks come and talk about it, but it's a small subset of four clinics, and it's for that unique feature that those clinics get this wraparound payment, which isn't true of the majority of practices in Oregon. So just a touch again, I think I've mentioned this, but most of you are well aware of the coordinated care organizations, but part of the, when we asked for people to apply to be a CCO, we asked what, you know, we want to see innovative payment. We want to move from fee-for-service to alternative payment mechanisms, and they needed to report back to us what they were going to accomplish, and in their transformation plans, they needed to set milestones and benchmarks for that. Not too dissimilar from some of the asks we had recently in our PEB RFP as to where they were moving to. They, as you know, are being paid in a global budget, and so they're given a calculated amount for them to spend, and then they have flexibility on how to do that with the idea that we want to pay for outcomes. We don't want to dictate how they spend the money per se, as long as we're doing it legally because it's federal dollars too. But that we, you know, these are the outcomes we want to see. And they have a incentive pool around certain metrics, specifically including the number of members that they will have in patient-centered primary care homes. And we've seen some dramatic improvements. I know Eastern Oregon CCO has gone from about 5% medical homes to about 40% now. I mean, they've really, really worked hard with those practices to get them certified and starting down that line of changing their model of care. And then the transformation plans on the new transformation fund is also similar, talking about some of the alternative payment, especially around primary care, which helps to backfill some of that loss of health home dollars. And so this just sort of, I just sort of outlined sort of where some of those transformation plan work is. When we looked across all the CCOs on what they were sort of doing, there's some pay for performance, there's some population-based payment shared risk arrangements, there's some population-based payment shared savings, and there's even some bundled payments that are happening in the CCOs in the Medicaid population. When we listened to the PEB applicants, some of that same stuff, because some of them were affiliated or were the CCOs that applied for that. But even in our larger plans, we also heard a lot of these similar kind of approaches where they're really trying to get away from that 9921 whatever kind of payment and really moving to partnering with the practices and paying the whole, you know, for that whole supportive thing. This is just a couple of examples. Care Oregon, has overtly said they're paying anywhere from $2 to $6 PMPM for their various tiers of what level patient-centered home you are. And Eastern Oregon is also doing that as well to help support those practices. I also wanted to add that, you know, as I said, there's benefit design. So when we change, you know, what happened when we changed PEBs, lowered the copay if you went to a patient-centered home, well, all of a sudden everyone kept calling their doctors and saying, how come you're not a patient-centered home? And we got all these calls like, what's a patient-centered home and how do I get certified? So it was pretty interesting that when you start to pair it with benefit design, and the patients come in clamoring for a different kind of care, it also drives change. And then as many of you know, we've got some, the
Quality Corporation is a public-private entity that has been monitoring quality in the primary care setting for many years, and their recent report that came out in last fall showed that that many of those quality metrics were better in the patient-centered primary care home setting versus clinics that were not designated. So they crosswalked with the patient-centered home recognized clinics. So they're showing that this investment in the PCPCHs is getting you higher quality. The other information we have is from our quarterly reports on the CCOs so far, and it shows that there's increased utilization of primary care than there was prior to the start of the CCOs and in our Medicaid data, and the reduced emergency room visits and spending and fewer unnecessary hospitalizations. And I think you're familiar with those reports. You get updates from Tina and folks regularly.
A couple questions. I apologize. But I wanted to get is there a requirement in the CCO transformation plans around a timeline for payment reform? It looks like there's perhaps 10 different CCOs that are doing different projects. Is there any required time frame in which they need to institute payment reform?
Well, I think it was negotiated with each of the CCOs to set their own milestones and benchmarks of where they were taking themselves, and then we're to be holding them accountable for that, right?
Right, right. We're supposed to make those improvements over a three-year period, so we're into year two now. So we, have a plan phase, an implement phase, a prove that you did it phase, and so we're trying to make all those things happen over the next 3 years.
So the expectation is by year three, each of the 17 CCOs will have some element of an alternative payment system, or is that the expectation of the...
Yeah, again, most of them are focused on the primary care world. Most of them are focused on. Some are doing some specialty bundled payments as well.
What we owe back to the state is a savings, and trying to find a way to do that through a variety of means. So it's not very prescriptive about, you need to get an alternative method to have an alternative method. It's what method can we do that will produce that savings. And so our plans all include different ways we think we can get there. Mm-hmm. And so it's a bit of an evolution of trial and error of making sure it doesn't have unintended consequences, and then, putting that into place, tweaking it as we need to as we go forward.
And I'm assuming the Oregon Health Authority or some other body is overseeing those efforts to try to understand how their effectiveness?
Right.
There's
monitoring over if they're meeting their benchmarks and milestones, and then there is a requirement from the federal government for us to do an evaluation. We're actually looking at sort of a midpoint evaluation even now, and through our state improvement model grant, there's sort of a additional evaluation efforts to look at what's happening and monitoring that over time.
So it's a bit of a two-edged sword, because on the one hand, when you take Medicaid business, which is the lowest payer of all payers, we can convince providers to experiment with their worst payer, because it can't get any worse, so they're willing to experiment some things. On the other hand, unless you have enough of a mass, they're not willing, and they have a hard time dealing with a little change that distracts them from where they get most of their money. And so it's hard to move their practice if you've also only touched 10% of their money. And so that's why efforts like PEB and other things to try to increase that critical mass, so that it has enough attention, but not so much that we kill them in the process. So we have to, we don't want to make a big mistake and kill off practices. So that's the needle we're trying to thread.
So I think one of the other complexities here is that in order to have a non-fee-for-service alternative payment methodology, there are some things in benefit design, specifically whether or not someone is whether they are assigned to a primary care practice, or whether we have to use some sort of assumptions to have an attribution methodology. So in the CCO methodology, because of the benefit design, everyone is assigned to a PCP, and so then you can make some practice. They know who their population is. So not only are they afraid about where their money comes from and how much they can do, but if they don't even know who their patients are, then it makes it more difficult. And so, you know, most commercial insurance plans today don't have a PCP assignment requirement, and has about 30% of their patients in that model, but, you know, 70, it's actually a little more than 70% do not. And so sometimes you can assign somebody and sometimes you can't. And that makes it, you know, more difficult to spread some of these, you know, global payment methodologies if you don't know who your population is that you're trying to serve.
And the Comprehensive Primary Care Home Initiative, the one we're doing with Medicare and those five payers, it's more of an attestation approach. The experience of the local payers was they tried to do something on a very small scale with 13 clinics, and it got really tedious to, you know, if that person jumped from John's plan to Bob's plan, then who was paying for that nurse practitioner in the clinic? And so the consensus was to try to be more of a testing, you know, not make the clinics report it per se. But it is a little bit more squishy as to whether, you know, who's paying for what. And so it is have to be sort of a collaborative team spirit on this, but it is hard to, like, you know, guarantee that if you're on a PPO product, like I'm on Providence PPO, that I might go to three different primary care providers, but only one of them's maybe getting paid for me. So it makes them a little anxious. But I think the conclusion in our comprehensive primary care homework in those 67 clinics was just to go with sort of a common attribution approach and just get the money out there. And you know, there's other payers that are benefiting from that who aren't paying that money into those clinics. But, you know, in the ultimate, it helps everybody if those clinics are successful at keeping folks out of the emergency room and out of the hospital. So the other point I wanted to just touch on that people often forget is, even though I might be getting paid as a clinic differently by the health plan, I might not be paying my docs or nurse practitioners or PA differently inside the clinic. And sometimes there is sort of a shared savings arrangement. Yeah. Sometimes there isn't. A lot of times it's like, you know, in my old practice days in the peak of managed care, it was like you will see 24 people every single day and keep up your volume. And that it sort of works against sort of that being able to do everything. So there is that sort of issue that, okay, the state might pay the plan differently, like Ruth, but then the plan has to pay the providers differently, and then how are the providers paying each other differently inside that clinic? So we need to keep in mind the different layers of payment, so payment within the payment. And just last, I mentioned it earlier, there was a report to the governor, which I can also get to you if you have not seen. He sent a letter to the policy board asking them to kind of take transformation beyond Medicaid and think about how to align across commercial, PEB, OEB, qualified health plans in exchange, around metrics, around moving the coordinated care model. And one was around bolstering primary care infrastructure. So the multi-payer approach is one, but also what else is needed to keep helping and sustaining these efforts in the patient-centered home. And so that work is just kind of getting started to try to respond to how to get more information about these recommendations, and they would be available by the end of 2014 back ahead of the by the, at least by fall or so, to try to figure out what else might be helpful to that. So, in summary, there's a lot of momentum going on both nationally and in Oregon to move away from fee-for-service to different kinds of payment, and primary care is a major focus both nationally and certainly in Oregon. We have a talented workforce. We have some flexibility around the different kinds of providers. I mean, I didn't even get into community health workers and peer wellness experts and some of the things these primary care clinics are using to outreach to to their patients. So there's a strong foundation here for doing continued reform. These new models of care, there's a strong need, and certainly in our modeling, it looks like there's a strong need for more NPs and PAs, and so trying to make it a favorable climate to practice in and encouraging more training of is really critical, because it's a long road to train docs, and even if, you know, you start, I mean, the family practice residency actually expanded to 4 years to try to get here in Oregon to try to get more training into those providers before they launch their careers, but that also slows down the process of getting those docs out and practicing. And then I think that thinking again, not staying stuck on fee-for-service as the only means in which to try to reinforce and build this infrastructure we need for primary care is really critical. And there is a lot of great efforts going on in the state at this moment about multi-payer collaboratives and individual provider arrangements with the clinicians.
Senator?
We always, at some time during any session that we have, is concerns about, you know, the use of naturopathic physicians, chiropractors, other types of providers. And I know, I just want you to confirm, the ACA is pretty clear that they do not cover naturopaths and chiropractors. I just need to be reminded again on...
Well, I'm not sure that the ACA per se. I think there's some language actually. I think that you all put into your legislation regarding that you wouldn't a plan would not not take a group just because they're a particular type of group, but would individually look at any provider to determine if they want to put it on their provider network. Dr. Wally Schaefer, who's the Medicaid medical director, and I have been having an integrative medicine advisory group that has met now about 3 or 4 times to start to have that conversation around the table, or representation from the chiropractic, the naturopathic, the acupuncturists, and the massage therapists. And there is a separate group that's working on the direct entry midwife concerns. And we also have, actually, Dr. Gluckman sits at the table with the more commercial insurance hat, and Dr. Satinspiel from one of the CCOs is there, and another doc who's always on the phone, so I'm blanking on his name at the moment, from All Care down in Southern Oregon, to just kind of think about, okay, so when you're getting certified, what is it? And it's very easy for all the... these entities to certify a doc or a nurse practitioner. They kind of know, you know, how a license happens, what the schooling is, what the trainings are, what the boards are. It's a little more unknown to them about what the requirements to get to be an acupuncturist are, and then it's all, or a massage therapist. So one of the things that's come up is trying to share best learnings and thinkings on how to credential these kind of providers, and how can we work to maybe get that information out to folks, maybe through our transformation center and other means, and working with the associations so that, you know, these patient-centered homes. I know I spend some time seeing patients at a Richmond clinic, one of the OHSUs, and it's a Tier 3 patient-centered home, and we have acupuncture services that come in, and there's a huge waiting line. So they're, you know, having the practices partner with these different kind of providers also is helpful. There's efforts of chiropractors partnering with nurse practitioners to be able, since chiropractors don't prescribe medications, how can they have the full comprehensive care inside a particular clinic? Working through some of those issues, trying to kind of figure out what are the avenues that would be useful and what are the barriers that are precluding folks to think about these other providers, just like thinking about NPs and PAs and other types of workers.
I hope that we will maybe address part of that, only because of patients who swear by, let's say, their chiropractor due to pain relief. And I just don't know enough about the CCO model or is there going to be flexibility? I guess it'll maybe be up to the patients to start making demands to whoever their primary care.
Well, there are actually chiropractors and naturopaths already in the networks of many of the CCOs. Dr. Satinspiel, for instance, in Eugene, it being a little more very interested in this type of care, have incorporated that in. But for other other areas of the state, they're just not sure whether they can afford to have that care. How are they thought of? So there's just a lot of information sharing that needs to happen. Some best practices. Some sharing from where that is helpful, because ultimately it is the decision of the plans as to who's in their network, and so who they contract with and how they contract with them. And so we don't want to get in the middle of that, but we also want to make sure there's enough information out there to make their own determinations and decisions on both sides.
Well, there's a cultural bias from some or amongst all this that I think we're slowly growing to maybe not be so TERF-oriented and be open to the actual what's most effective with the patient.
Are you referencing chiropractors as a primary care provider or more just within the...
I don't want to go there. but I do want to understand if in the CCO model or a primary care home model, a patient care could be better taken care of through chiropractic manipulation rather than just getting a pain pill. I mean, that's simplifying the issue, but
I think a lot of plans do provide those types of services as constellation of services, and many of us use chiropractors, acupuncturists for pain treatment. I think the question that John's bringing up is really the whether or not a naturopath or a chiropractor can function in their office as a primary care medical home.
I didn't want to lead it that way.
Right. But that is an issue, because particularly in rural environments, I think there are a lot of rural environments that are pretty dependent on a variety of different types of providers that actually have functioned for a very long period of time in that role. So I think that that is an issue that has been a challenge for some communities.
So I think one of the cornerstones here is that to be a primary care medical home, you do need to be able to provide a broad scope of services. So in this state, naturopaths do have prescribing authority, so they meet those criteria. Chiropractors do not have prescribing authority, so they wouldn't really be able to provide on their own, in a standalone clinic, the comprehensive services that would encompass primary care, because they don't they can't prescribe. I think that that's part of the evolution of where we're going. But I do think I would have to say that naturopaths do have the licensure to be able to apply their services across a broad range of primary care services.
Mm-hmm. And then if you tie it back to payment, if you're doing a global capitation to the clinic, and then how that clinic pays versus if you're having to worry about billing an individual provider visit, it gets more difficult.
And if I could comment, it also gets back to evidence-based care on both across all providers. And that's where the tug of war really actually becomes, because we don't have evidence-based care developed as much as most people think we do. And so you get into arguments about what's effective and what's not. Even things that we often think are well-established, and we should know what the evidence-based care says, often it's not. There are conflicting opinions about what we think is standard treatment. So that creates a lot of difficulties with folks.
Yes. Sure. Well, and I think this just speaks to, this is about outcomes and value, right? And it shouldn't matter what provider it is. If it's in their scope of practice, if they're providing better value than another, we should allow that to happen. And that's at the core of what the CCOs are trying to do, is right, show that value equation for the services that are being delivered, regardless of who's delivering it.
Right.
And I think that's got to be a key focus of our work moving forward, is sort of the value equation. Whether the evidence is there is a whole other issue, but getting that value for the service and getting to that outcome, I think, is an important piece we need to keep in the front of our minds during this process.
Any so with that, I think I have talked myself out of...
Any questions from the phone?
Very good.
Coralie? Mary?
No.
Could I make one more comment related to our presentation so far? A couple of places we've talked about measurement, and we've talked about the 99213 and how do you get intensity into it. We have a constant struggle between documenting and getting away from fee-for-service payments. Because every time we come up with one of these things, the way we want to measure it is we go right back to fee-for-service and we go right back to how to document in a code through the medical record what supports that code. And that is going to be quite a challenge, I think, for us.
So, can I get a clarification? So, to me, this evolution of healthcare and how we want the future state to be is really a pay-for-value versus pay-for-volume. It sounds like we're translating that to mean a move away from fee-for-service. And I guess what I would probably say is, from my viewpoint, it's more an enhancement, possibly, of fee-for-service and creating new revenue streams and new incentive models that supplement fee-for-service. I don't know if I'm 100% committed to abandoning fee-for-service. It's a question of how do you re-engineer it. So, and I just don't want to leave that message unsaid if the purpose of this is saying how do we leave that path.
Yeah, and I certainly didn't want to imply that we're going to entirely abandon that, because I think there are clearly parts of care delivery systems that you're going to struggle to figure out any other way to pay for it other than actually paying for a particular service, particularly on specialty side, things like that, that are going to be very hard to do in a capitated environment. So, but again, I think that our charge is really focusing on primary care and behavioral health. So as we look at it, that's what we want to do, is figure out, well, how do we make sure that we are able to provide a constellation of payment systems that most effectively get to that value equation? And I think that's our goal, is to come up with those types of recommendations.
Okay, the only reason I bring that up is just when I look at the principles of the task force draft, just one of the bullet points says facilitate from fee-for-service to CAP. Mm-hmm. I would probably say I'd like to be more open to how we look at the evolution of payment.
But it's primarily capitated. I feel the MCO model it is a good model, but I don't think we could maybe entirely get away from fee-for-service, but it would be nice to work toward that end.
I mean, when we've had discussions in health fund board days, which is the predecessor to the policy board, we had discussed how certain things, like if I sew up a laceration or do a particular procedure, sometimes those are things that just always are going to have to stay fee-for-service versus capitating me for my population of kids and adults and making sure I'm doing all the right screenings, preventative, being there for them to manage their chronic disease. So I think there's an element that in our discussions in those days was that there was probably some element that there would need to be some fee-for-service. Although on the flip side, specialty procedures, there may be bundled payments around to control costs as well.
I mean, is this the right forum to talk about the pros and cons of these different models?
Mm-hmm. I believe that's the intention, is really to have that dialogue and to talk about, you know, how can we create sort of a framework by which we can assure that a level of care and outcomes is the focus. How we get there and the way that the payment system will influence that. And I think there's all the data would say that. So I think that our purpose is to have that, some of that pros and cons discussion. As I look at it, I think that's our role.
So I'll throw out a quick statement and then I'll drop the subject for today. So capitation, I grew up with capitation back in the 90s with a predominantly Medicare HMO plan. And big believer, capitation does create predictability. It creates a steady cash flow to the provider so that they can manage their business around the capitation. But what I would want to throw out there as a flaw of capitation is, as the consumer gets more engaged in health promotion and they take more ownership over their health care, if capitation is the blunt, one-dimensional vehicle that was in the past, then you create a sunk cost to health care. And it isn't really necessarily the right thing for the consumer who actually is managing their health care and changing their behaviors and actually probably deserves to be a different calibration of healthcare costs than someone who isn't. And by socializing the cost of healthcare through capitation, you kind of create a disincentive.
And just to add to that, though, prevention is left out in a capitation model. And I, of course, here I have my public health nurse hat on. If we start focusing a lot on outcomes and prevention, and we know that prevention does work, if we can get that culture into the medical home model, I feel that's where it's hard for me to figure out how fee-for-service will work, because we're always paying for sick care and we don't pay for well care. And so that's why I want to make sure that we don't fall back onto just a fee-for-service, because it's prevention to keep people out of the ERs, to get your blood pressure down, to eat right, to exercise. All of that, I feel, is very much a part of what should happen in a primary care model, and it's not the culture that we have yet.
So I think when we're talking about primary care services, we have to, I think we're going to be very dependent on services being delivered in a different way than they currently are. So I'm sensitive to your concerns, John, but, you know, face-to-face visits is a pretty inefficient way to deliver care.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we take a look at some health services research data as an example, a Medicare-age patient goes and sees a provider in South Florida, and they have hypertension and no other medical concerns, their routine visit recommendation would be to come back in 6 weeks, 2 months, and in Portland, Oregon, it might be 6 months. You know, and you know, one of the issues here is what's the level of variation that occurs around how different people take care of patients. So I think we really want to empower providers to be able to care for people in the most efficient way possible, and empower patients to get care in the way that works for them, for their particular needs. So I would like to see a primary care payment mechanism that doesn't dictate whether someone is seen via a face-to-face visit, whether their care is delivered via secure video platform, whether their care is delivered via email, whether their care is delivered by a telephone call, or whether their care is delivered by a group visit. And so you can still do some of those things. And you know, from the provider point of view, you know, I practiced primary care internal medicine for over 25 years. How many bullets in my review of systems do I really need to document so that I could justify a level 4 code instead of a level 3 code? The documentation requirements have no relationship to what actually needs to be in the medical record so that you could transmit your thinking and your thought process so that you remember what you did the last time, or your colleague who's seeing that patient could see them the last time, because we're just beholden to this bullet system and the evaluation and management codes, which is just very unsophisticated and doesn't serve doctors, nurse practitioners, PAs, or patients very well. So I, at the same time, if you don't create some incentive for people providing service that requires more intensity, then there could be some service flaws. And I think that's, you know, because you want to be sure that when patients do need to be seen, that they are actually seen. But I would maintain that for some of the chronic illness care, much of it can be delivered in a non-face-to-face setting much more efficiently than it currently is using, you know, technology. And I'd also make the case that for many self-limited complaints, not seeing a healthcare provider at all, but providing people with self-help and some guidelines would be far more efficient, and you can't do that in a primarily fee-for-service system.
There's probably some data that might say it was safer as well.
It always scares me when physicians say things like that.
So, points all very well taken. I think that's the challenge of our work ahead of us, is really to say, are there ways that we can create so venue is it doesn't have to be face to face? Because again, I think today's system, we're getting what we pay people to do. We're getting lots of visits and lots of volume, but are we getting that same level of value? And I think that we're at a point where we can no longer afford the escalating costs of that model, given the aging of the population, increased complexity, the issues around wellness, and our sort of deteriorating overall wellness of American citizens. So I think that that's the our hope is to try to do that. Are there other questions or things that came out, either reactions to some of these principles? I really appreciate what you said, John. Is there additional information? One of the things that was brought up clearly by our colleagues in behavioral health is that we need to understand what the model of behavioral health delivery needs to look like. And again, we've been talking a lot about primary care medical homes, but what does it look like in a behavioral health, I'll use the term medical home, or as Dr. Smith was talking about, someone who receives the vast majority of their care in a behavioral health environment, what does that look like? And then how does that delivery system support it? Because we know some of the workforce issues in that environment are also challenging. So we'll hope to bring some more information related to that into our discussions in the future. John.
Dr. Smith, and I probably should know this answer, but I'll ask you. Your original slide about the 12,000 physicians and then kind of the
breakdown,
the supply and demand dynamics going forward. Do we have the ratio of physicians to population for this market versus for markets like Colorado or other markets? Just to kind of get a feel of our per capita.
I'll have to double check if they've done that calculation or that's part of the work going forward that the workforce committee's doing, but I can get back to you on that.
It'd just be interesting though, if we're
our ratio of people to providers.
And I think one of the factors, too, that we don't understand, we're looking at some of that data related to ER utilization, some of those things in the first part of the CCO operation. We don't know what, as of January 1, what happened when you all of a sudden have an influx of, perhaps up to 30% larger patient base on that CCO environment. Mm-hmm. We don't know what that. I can say what it looks like in Lane County. It's not pretty, but the reality is that I think that that data, as we go forward, it won't look quite as encouraging as perhaps some of that initial initial data.
Well, I think the modeling report took into account the increased population coming because of the ACA. So that report that I sent out ahead does have that calculated in. So it was, again, based on estimates. I know personally in my clinic, which is a federally qualified health center, and we see uninsured, we now have people coming in with an insurance card and saying, okay, now I want my smoking cessation patch or pills, and I want this because now I have insurance. And so these patients were already patients but are now having a means in which to get additional care.
But it's truly a mixed bag of folks, not as much pent-up demand in some cases as we thought. In other cases, people ready with the demand of what they want. And some people who are truly very sick who haven't gotten any care. But there's also a group of people who are not used to, because they have had to pay, they don't run to the doctor every 2 minutes. And they're continuing not to do that. So time will tell.
I know that in our community, we have 9,000 unassigned OHP clients. So that would tell me that we have some capacity challenges or access challenges. So, I think that creates the sort of pressure testing of the ACA. In some areas, I think, have done better than others. It'll be interesting to see statewide how that shakes out. So other comments or thoughts that came out of the presentation, thank you very much, Dr. Smith. That was a very, very helpful overview. John.
So, thanks to Janine. She's a great resource for all of us during this process, as you can tell by the presentation. There's much more that you can talk to her about, I'm sure. I just want to be clear on what your expectations are for this draft. Do you want us to send you feedback electronically to the group, or how do you want to handle any feedback on this? And what's your expectation about, is this a living document? Do you want it final at some point during our work, and then we move forward? Or I just want to get a better sense for that.
Yeah. My sense is this is entirely entirely a working document and just to help assist us in as we go forward, and that I would see this changing, morphing. Many of the points are already brought up around nomenclature, which has has a sort of set implications. I think we're going to have to adjust as we go forward. What I'd like is that as we'll send it out electronically, and then I'd love to get comments, additional checkpoints, things that you would love to see out of this. And then as we formulate that, I think it will help to shape our discussions and our dialogue. And as we eventually get to a point where we're going to hopefully have a series of recommendations, that we would be able to address many of these issues with those recommendations. And again, it's what we don't want to do is try to boil the ocean. What we wanted to create something that's doable and as our practical recommendations to go back to the legislature. But I think it helps us to look big and then focus. And get to some things that we can perhaps move forward. That was my intent.
Great, thank you. It's helpful.
Any other additional comments?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Coralie. Mr. Chair, this is Coralie. Is there a possibility of getting those that PowerPoint handed out to us? I couldn't see it on the video here at all, and I couldn't understand anything that was being said at the speaker there. So I was hoping that maybe I could get a copy of that PowerPoint somehow.
Absolutely. We'll make sure there's a copy of the PowerPoint and any of the other documents that have come across our table, so to speak. We'll make sure everybody has electronic copies of those.
And Coralie, it is on OLIS. So
oh, great. The PowerPoint is as well?
Yes. It's on OLIS
okay.
already. So whether, and if you can't get it downloaded, just let us know.
Let us
know.
We'll
mail you a hard copy. The only thing that's not on OLIS at this point is the document that Co-Chair Kincaid handed out on the payment reform principles, because I didn't get that electronically, but once I have that, that will be on OLIS, and then I will email it to you all in addition.
And I can.
Great, I appreciate that so much. I really wanted to hear this one.
And also, if you wanted to talk one-on-one, I'd be more than willing to talk to you, and if you have questions about the presentation.
I suspect behind every one of those slides is about 30 slides.
Thank you so much.
So that's the intention. Okay, very good. Sort of topic, I just want to make sure the group is aware that we did submit a report to the healthcare committees verbally and on paper to the House Health Care Committee. House?
The House Healthcare Committee.
Yeah, that's what I said. House Healthcare Committee. The Senate will go electronically. They had already finished their work, so we weren't able to provide that in person, so to speak. So hopefully everybody got a copy of that. That's also available. Make you aware. The comments from the House group I do want to share in that there was concern around, again, the importance of bringing in the discussion around the behavioral health system. And we tend to concentrate much of our attention and actually even the composition is largely folks that are have their attention on the sort of the medical side. So we want to make sure we have that good balance. And so what they wanted to point out that, and again, I think as the other input that we've gotten, we want to make sure we put attention, because that is a significant part of our charge. Did want to bring that feedback. In that light, our next meeting is scheduled for the 21st of March. Again, it's this fun time of 8 to 10, so hopefully that is workable for everybody. We will be sending out meeting announcements for that, but also for subsequent meetings so that people can get those on their calendars. We've had sort of decided on the third Friday of each month from 8 to 10, so we could try to begin to schedule these out ahead of time. So Sandy will help work on that piece, and that will go forward. At the next discussion, I think that we would like an opportunity to talk a little bit more about and learn a little bit more about the behavioral health delivery system, how it exists today, and how they, in fact, that group of providers envisions the future. because I think that's an important discussion because we want to, again, skate to where the puck's going. And, again, on that behavioral health side, I think that that is just coming off the Olympics. I was thinking about hockey. Unfortunately, I'm not a Canadian. The reality is that I think that we can learn a lot from much of the work that's happening on the behavioral health side as well. So we'll bring that discussion next time. We'll have maybe perhaps a little bit further discussion on the principles as well. Are there other additional things you would like to bring into the discussion at this next meeting? Anything
particular? Where will the next meeting be?
You will be here again.
And actually, it's been asked that we have a less formal setting, and so that's why we chose 343, because then we'll just set up tables out there rather than at the dais all the time. You guys can just talk across from each other and things like that. So we've set it up for the next several meetings for 343, 8 to 10 in our square center.
That's unfair. Any other comments for the good of the order? Okay, we will go ahead and adjourn.